I'm going to ask Steve and Mandy to come up.
One of the things at camp, they had lots of evening entertainment for the young people. And one of the evenings was a lip sync battle, if anybody had any seen it on TV. So Mandy and I, well, Mandy chose for us to do.
It's your fault.
Yeah. John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John. So we've been practicing this for a number of weeks at home. And that was our song. And you may have a photo. We did get dressed up, didn't we? And
yeah,
we had a bit of fun. Yeah, somewhere. Yeah. We had a bit of fun doing it. So,
So you find yourself doing slightly mad things. Was there any sensible things that you did during the week?
You're the sensible one.
Yeah, this year there was loads of sensible things, actually, and one of the main ones was prayer. Because we had 87 15 to 17 stroke 18-year-olds, we had a bit more free time, so really prayer was one of the major things that we did a lot of, and it was just absolutely amazing how God changed them. We had lots of children from Liverpool that don't go to church, and they were just like throw-offs from Christian charities. And it was amazing how God changed them from the Saturday right into the Thursday. And then he changed them again on the Friday when they realized that reality was that they had to go back home to their circumstances. But prayer was a big one for us this year. And we've got loads of examples, but Steve said, I can't go on. I've got to just answer the questions. So I can't tell you all of them unless Phil lets us.
That was the only question I had. So you can. So you were, before you went, you were a bit concerned about the staff, that it was going to be a slightly different week. Was any of that founded, or was it all good?
I think we knew some of the team. We didn't know some of the team. So I think we gelled and got on well. We had a few different characters, I think, with the staff, which was quite good. And we had a good laugh, didn't we, most of the staff. So that was good. The cookhouse was good. Well, Gwen wasn't there. The cookhouse kept us well fed. Lots of good food and things. That was good.
Yeah, we went with lots of different people that we didn't know, and they'd been to camp a number of times. But what we realised really this year was you have to be strong. You have to be ready to go to camp to serve the children. You have to be spiritually strong. And it was strange, really, because we know that we needed lots of prayers, especially after last year when we came back and we were really, really burnt out. But this year we had everybody praying for us all the time, and you know what, it worked, because Steve and I felt really, really strong, and because we were strong, the enemy didn't really attack us. He attacked a lot of other leaders, but because we knew that the prayers were working, so we were, you know, thank you for all that. And but I do really think that you have to be ready, and you have to be spiritually ready to do the jobs that we did.
So I've got 4 or 5 photos. Do you want to tell us what's going on in these? Do you want that?
Yeah. This one was, it was quite humbling, really. This lad had been to camp last year and he'd come this year. And last year he had severe acne, didn't he, Steve? And this year he was a year older. He'd had a load of course of antibiotics and he looked differently. And one of the sessions in the morning, we just sat around the netball pitch, and if anybody wanted to come and pray, they came. And he sat with me and this other leader, which I didn't really know very well. And every day in his school life, he'd been bullied for being a Christian. He got bullied last year. He even got bullied at camp last year. And you know what? He just wanted to pray for bullying. And it was so humbling to sit there and pray with him. And when I was praying with him, I looked up to the sky and I saw like Chosen One in the sky, and I could feel how God was so joyful and so delighted that he stood up in his school, being the only Christian of 15, and he stood firm. And you know what? When he was praying, he prayed for his bullies. So that was quite hard. And then at the end of the prayer, he gave me a message. He gave me a psalm. So the next thing, we went away. We took him to the worship tent. He got up with his guitar playing. He'd never been in the music group before. And then a few hours later, he came running up to me. He said, look what I've done for you. I've done a verse. And he wrote this verse in chalk. And that night, I went to bed about 12 o'clock, and I sat there and read the verse he gave me. And you know what? All I thought about was his Christian parents. He came home every day, he said, and cried. And his parents supported him. And this verse, I could feel, I wonder if I could be that strong if anybody did that to one of my children. So it was quite humbling, the whole experience. God changed it round. It was just, we had loads of incidents like that, but this lad, absolutely amazing. How he stood his ground in school, I will never know, but he only did it with the help of God. The psalm he gave me was this. And I gave it to the girls the day after in our choir because I felt as though it was for them going back to their ground. And it was, I pushed you back and about to fall, but the Lord helped me. The Lord is my strength and my defense, and he has become my salvation. And I said to the girls in the quiet time, if you've learnt anything, if just one time you think about doing something wrong, just think about the time we've had at camp and just think about that.
Quite worried to show the other pictures now.
I didn't know that.
That was really good. And it's really good that if you go to camp a number of years, you see children really growing in their faith and see what they're becoming. And then years' time, you see them going back as leaders. Yeah,
just to add to that, for the same young lad, on the Friday, he came running up to us with a massive big smile on his face, just beaming, and said, the other lad, one of the lads who come from Liverpool who didn't know Jesus, had just given his life, but he'd done it with this young lad and two of the other campers. And it was just amazing because he was just so pleased that this is a young lad actually come to Jesus, but he'd made that commitment with him and two of the campers. It was, no, and as you say, that young lad, he's a smashing lad. But he was so, I suppose, joyous in the fact that this young person had committed to Christ, but with him as well. And that was so special.
Yeah. So some of the pictures, that's a picture of that's the worship tent. I've never been to camp when that's been in use. That's a new thing on me. So that's where all the praise nights and things.
So you have your daytime session in there. And then you go off to your group time, then you have your evening sessions in there, and it's a great, you know, venue for it. Obviously, it's a tent, the young people are all sitting together, you have your chats, but the worship is good, it can really lift you, and to see all the kids raising their hands, you know, just glorifying God, that is what, it is a special place. I think it says the tent of meeting, you know, from Exodus, and it's a really good place.
Yeah. And another really special place. If you've been on one of the weekends, you'll recognise this, the bonfire site. But at a week of camp, it's something different, isn't it? Something very different to anywhere else.
Yeah, I think we were trying to think about one or two things just to pick out about what was so good at the weekend. And for me, it was on this, I think this was the Friday evening, at the campfire, the kids all, they were getting around the fire, and I just started worshipping and singing songs themselves. It's just spontaneous, and it was so surreal just to sit back and watch the young people. So it was about 15 or 20, then more and more came and joined and started worshipping together. So that was I think one of the high points for me, definitely.
Great. And then, a couple of weeks ago, before you went, we prayed for Eleanor that she'd have a good week. Did she have a good week?
Eleanor did have a good week. I was sitting with the padre one day, and Eleanor sat. We pretended that she did tell people that we were in mum and dad, but we said, it's up to you. If you want to tell people, that's fine. So she sat next to us one day, and I said, have you had a good time? Would you come again? Nah. Are you going to see anybody after camp? I don't think so. I said, so what about it? She said, oh, I'm going now, ta-ra. So at the end of the week, we said to her, do you want to come home with us in the car, or are you going on the bus with your mates? She said, no, I go on the bus. So she went on the bus. And then all Saturday, all Sunday, all that she talked about was camp. And you know what? I love camp, and I was fed up by this point. She was going on and on. She'd met so-and-so. They were all in this big group chat. They were meeting here, meeting there. And you know what? She absolutely loved it. A few days later, she'd gone to Mackie's to go to work, and she comes home. She said, oh, a group of them from camp, boys and girls, had gone in to see her. So she was made up there, and then, what day was it? Friday night? Steve and I hadn't said anything to her. She came in one day, and she sat there, and she said, I might go to Maitland one night. I said, oh, yeah, oh, that's nice. And then she said, if I go to university in Liverpool, there's a church in Liverpool called the Liverpool One Church. I might even go there. Oh, I said, yeah, very good. Steve gets up at 12 o'clock Friday night, goes and picks her up from work, and one of the girls whose mum had had a brain tumour at camp was in my group, and she kept in touch with Eleanor because this girl, you know, she's absolutely lovely. She came into Mackie's and was talking to Eleanor. She said to Steve in the car, I might go to Ignite next week, and I might ask my friend from college to go. So I thought, oh my word, how amazing is this? 12 o'clock, half 12 at night, I woke up, and there she is on the toilet singing Hillsong song, which is Oceans from camp. And she'd never heard that song before she went to camp. But you know what? The seeds are planted. We've seen it plant when we've been to camp ourselves and other children. It's just, whatever God's work's got to be done, he'll do it. And he'll do it with us. He'll do it with Eleanor. And he'll do it with all the children there because they've all come away differently. Every time you go to camp, you come away differently.
Is it worth putting that picture into some sort of context so that people know what's going on? It wasn't the weekly wash?
If people have been to camp, behind the rec room where you tend to sit in the evenings, there's a natural bank. So down there you've got a slippy, slidey slide. So the kids go on it. At the top you've got the leaders who are throwing loads of baby oil on the slide. You've got people side to side with buckets of water and hoses getting them all as they come down. So they come down the big slide and then come into like a bit of a channel of water. But there's quite a few of those, but it is great. It's a highlight of the day. It's a highlight of sports day because at the end of sports day, which was the Monday, and it rained a little bit, didn't really matter, was going on that slip. Because you have a big water fight, then you go on that slide, and the kids just love it. But, it is great, and it's one of the highlights, definitely.
And it seems that you found a new friend.
I've got a new friend.
You moved on from Mandy.
You weren't supposed to show Mandy these photos. This Charlotte is the girls' leader, and I tell you what, I've never met anybody who's so creative, so clever and creative of the things she finds to do. Really good. We had a couple of photos when Mandy wasn't looking.
The first year that I went as a leader, her oldest brother was in my group. And I've been with Charlotte as a camper, and again, it's great to see, and it's great to see that the camper's coming up and taking over, and taking responsibility for this great gift that God has given.
I think just the two photos. Obviously, one was the beach party. We had a beach party day, and the right hand one, I mean, Dickie, but we had a formal evening on the Friday, and I'm not sure whether Phil's got, but they decorated the whole the dining room. And the kids loved it because they're all coming in the nice clothes. We had a rave, and then you went to the worship, and it was like, how are you going to get away from having a rave? The kids are all like this to worship, but they managed it really well. It was good. Yeah, it was really good.
The final picture. This is just lots of people, and I think this really shows. If you've been to the church weekend, this is the netball field. And at a church weekend, it's empty. There's a couple of kids playing football. But it really does show how alive the site comes. And it really is a blessing to be there, I think.
I think the site's so big. There's always space to sit down, talk. There's campers everywhere just playing football or something, or doing something all the time. It is just, I think, amazing. But I think if I just share maybe a highlight from mine. What was different this year, because the age 15 to 17, is how many of the campers wanted to talk to you about how they fill that void when they go back. It's football to be camp bubble. So being in the bubble at camp, it was how they can continue being with, you know, so close to Jesus all the time. And I was saying, well, look, you know, in your normal life, you might go to church on a Sunday, you might go another day, you might go to something in the week. This is like, being at camp is like being at a football cup final every day, you know, or going to see your favourite pop band. So you won't have this every day because you're not going to go and worship in the morning, worship in the evening. So it's how to fill that void. And it's so, a lot of them were just saying, look, get in, as you say, group chats, wasn't it, and things, staying in little groups or doing more things about camp, you know, in the future. That's what we were trying to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
Steve and I will probably go back to camp, but we might change our roles next year. We'll see what God's got in plan for us. But they do, especially on a Friday, the camp has changed because they know what they've got to go home to. But you know what? Jesus is the same. He's still in us when we come home. So when we go back to school, he's still here with us. So like Steve said, we try and get them to stay in touch because we can't stay in touch with them. We try and get them to stay in touch with one another because you have to be with like-minded people to have your walk with Christ because it makes it a lot easier for them.
So we started thinking about forgiveness. We've been forgiven a lot. We thought a bit about that. But what does forgiveness look like? It's all very well to say we need to forgive, but what does it look like? Well, as we sort of head to think about that, it struck me recently something rather strange about music and musicians. You know, one of the things you often hear songs about is love. Kind of, where would the world of pop be without songs about love? But musicians often seem to be hopeless at putting into practice what they sing about. The most recent spat seems to have been Katy Perry and Taylor Swift, who seem to cordially loathe each other for reasons that just seem complicated. But you can go back a long way earlier than that. John Lennon and Paul McCartney. They sang All You Need Is Love and then pretty well ignored each other for the rest of John Lennon's life. Pink Floyd, David Gilmour and Roger Waters made some of the greatest albums ever, but actually didn't like each other, more than didn't like each other. Apparently, at Live 8, they actually managed to rehearse and perform without speaking to each other. Simon and Garfunkel, just the same. All these bands that just can't get on. And there's Oasis. Classic albums, but Noel and Liam Gallagher spent most of their time fighting, and it seems they still can't stand each other. Which is particularly strange, because the song we're going to be thinking about this morning is Oasis, Don't Look Back in Anger. Which is something that the pair of them seem to do all the time. This morning, we're finishing our summer series on new songs, old songs. We've been looking at some of the big songs of the last generation and seeing how, while they often flag up some of the big questions of life, they rarely seem to have much in the way of answers. So, Ed Sheeran's Castle on the Hill. It talks all about nostalgia. But then you realize that nostalgia doesn't actually work, so what can you put in its place? Radiohead's No Surprises, it just highlights the way that life can be so disappointing, but the song doesn't have any answers to that situation. And this morning, a song that, although it's over 20 years old, came back into prominence a couple of months ago when it became pretty well an anthem after the Manchester bombing. Oasis, Don't Look Back in Anger. Of course, one of the things with many modern songs is figuring out what they actually are about. And that's definitely true with Don't Look Back in Anger. Even Noel Gallagher, who wrote it, admits that he had been indulging in illegal substances when he wrote it, and he's not got a clue what it's about. But there's one theme that does seem to me to kind of dominate that song. Why Don't Look Back in Anger? It seems that it's about having been hurt by someone, but not allowing that to make you bitter. Take that look from off your face. You ain't ever gonna burn my heart out. And so Sally can wait. She knows it's too late as we're walking on by. Her soul slides away, but don't look back in anger. I heard you say, don't look back in anger. Don't let what has been done to you affect you too deeply. Don't let it burn your heart out. But is that the best you can do when you've been hurt? Especially when you go to the last line of the song. But don't look back in anger. Don't look back in anger, I heard you say. At least not today. It's almost like, you know, I'll forgive you today, but maybe tomorrow I'll change my mind. And I'll do it, not for your sake, but for mine. You ain't ever going to burn my heart out. I guess that, yeah, it is better than out-and-out revenge. But is that really the best that we can do? Is that the best that we can manage? We've seen right through this series where modern songs can kind of flag up an issue, like the issue of forgiveness. Actually, we need to turn to those much older songs, the Psalms, for real answers. So let's do that now as we turn to Psalm 4. And Will is going to come and read it for us.
This morning's Bible reading is Psalm 4 and can be found on page 544 of the Pew Bibles. Answer me when I call to you, my righteous God. Give me relief from my distress. Have mercy on me and hear my prayer. How long will you people turn my glory into shame? How long will you love delusions and seek false gods? Know that the Lord has set apart his faithful servant for himself. The Lord hears when I call to him. Tremble and do not sin. When you are on your beds, search your hearts and be silent. Offer the sacrifices to the righteous and trust in the Lord. Many, Lord, are asking, who will bring us prosperity? Who let the light of your faces shine on us? Fill my heart with joy when their grain and new wine abound. In peace I will lie down and sleep, for you alone, Lord, make me dwell in safety. This is the word of the Lord.
Answer me when I call to you, my righteous God. Give me relief from my distress. Have mercy on me and hear my prayer. David was going through a tough time. There were people who were attacking him, maybe literally, maybe with their words. He knew that he didn't deserve it, which I guess made it even worse. He was being unfairly treated. His glory had been turned into shame. And other people were believing the lies that were being told about him. How long will you love delusions and seek false gods? Or actually, a more accurate translation, how long will you love delusions and seek lies? So what do? When someone is attacking you and others are going along with it, what do when people are slandering you behind your back and others seem happy to believe them? What do when somebody is just persecuting you? Do you just decide to turn away from it? Don't look back in anger? Pretend it's not happening? David actually had a different response. Tremble and do not sin. When you are on your beds, search your hearts and be silent. Offer the sacrifices of the righteous and trust in the Lord. Or as if you've got your Bibles open, you'll see there's a footnote at the bottom that says, actually, it could be in your anger, do not sin, which I think makes more sense of the passage. So, just think. It's the end of the day. It's been a tough day. Worst of all, people have been really having a go, attacking you. Someone at work has just gone off on one, been complaining about you, you've ended up in trouble. Or maybe you've just discovered that a close friend has been saying some pretty unkind things about you behind your back to another friend. It's not been a great day. You go to bed. What thoughts are in your mind? Very probably not hugely charitable ones. It's only natural, isn't it? You lie there and you're kind of thinking of all that's been done to you. And then you start thinking of the things you wish you'd said. Or maybe the things you're going to say next time you see them. You're not planning revenge, not exactly. But what has happened is filling your thoughts. And you just want to do something about it. How long will you people turn my glory into shame? How long will you love delusions and seek lies? And so you lie there in bed with what has happened stewing in your mind. What do you do? In your anger, do not sin. When you're on your beds, search your hearts and be silent. Yeah, you might start off angry, but don't sin. Actually, what David says is a reminder that sin isn't just doing something bad to someone. It's actually thinking about doing it. So that list of sins that we started off with earlier, they're just the actual ones you physically do. Add in all the times you think, and you get even bigger numbers. Lying there, stewing about the situation, planning what you want to do to somebody, that's sin. So instead of doing that, search your hearts and be silent. That's what Paul says in Ephesians 4, which is almost certainly quoting from Psalm 4. In your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you are angry. Just turn away from thoughts of revenge. Don't look back in anger. At first, it seems as though David is agreeing with Noel Gallagher. A bit of an unusual combination, I grant you, but there you are. Don't plan for revenge. It won't do you any good. Of course, in the song, Don't Look Back in Anger, the reason for not seeking revenge, the reason for forgiving, seems to be for your own benefit. You ain't ever going to burn my heart out. And it's true that unforgiveness generally only hurts the person who is refusing to forgive. So forgiving is therapeutically good. But David isn't just talking about that. He goes a whole lot further. Because down in verse 7, fill my heart with joy when their grain and new wine abound. Catch that? Fill my heart with joy when their new wine, when their grain and new wine abound. How could David pray that? Because what that is a prayer that these people who are doing something nasty to me, when something good happens to them, make me happy. Can you really pray that? I think that's amazing. It's not just kind of tolerating somebody else. It's actually saying that you want good things to happen to these people who are doing bad things to you, and you want to be happy when it happens. Mostly, you'd expect somebody to be praying, fill my heart with joy when they slip on a banana skin. No, just the opposite. Actually, if you look this verse up in different versions of the Bible, it can be translated in different ways. Often it's translated, you have filled my heart with greater joy than when their grain and new wine abound. It's all to do with how you translate certain words and the oddities of Hebrew. But it might be that David is saying that his relationship with God gives him joy even when bad things are happening to him. When other people are making his life hard. And that is a great thing, to know that even in when there's got this kind of storm of opposition swirling around you, you can still know joy. It takes us back to something we saw last Sunday if you were here, that when God is your greatest desire, human disappointments won't cripple you. But even though that's all gloriously true and great news, I think David is saying more than that, and that what we have here actually makes the most sense. In your anger, do not sin. When you're on your beds, search your hearts and be silent. Offer the sacrifices of the righteous and trust in the Lord. Instead of planning and seeking revenge, do what is right. And doing what is right can be a sacrifice. But still, praying for your enemies when they're trying to hurt you and spoil your life, it is a tough ask. Mandy was talking about that lad at camp who was being bullied and wanted to pray for the people who were bullying him. How do you do that? You see, I think the only way that prayer like that is even remotely possible is when you also have David's trust in the Lord. Answer me when I call to you, my righteous God. Know that the Lord has set apart his faithful servant for himself. The Lord hears when I call to him. David's trust in the Lord meant that he knew that God is righteous. He'll do what is right. David could safely leave dealing with what his enemies had done in God's hands. Whatever they were doing, God had set David apart for himself. He was in God's hands. So David could do what's right and trust in God's justice. But even then, not just forgiving your enemies in the sense of not trying to get revenge, but actually praying for their good, where does that come from? And I think it can only come from recognizing how good God has been to you. David knew that. David knew that he'd done some serious stuff. Most notably, he had an affair with Bathsheba, then had her husband killed in an attempt to cover his tracks. But when he asked God to forgive him, God did. And not only that, God went on to bless him. If David had received forgiveness like that, then surely he had to be willing to give forgiveness like that. And that, of course, is what that parable of Jesus, which we heard earlier, is all about. The first servant had been forgiven a huge debt. So when he then refused to forgive a much smaller debt himself, everybody knew it was obviously wrong. Of course, even though David knew that he'd received God's forgiveness, he wouldn't really have understood how that could happen. But we can. Because it wasn't just that God kind of let us off the wrong things that we've done. He actually took the consequences of that sin on himself. Jesus, the Son of God, took on himself all that I have done wrong. And he died in my place. And then, not only did he do that, but he then showered blessings on me. He gave me eternal life. He gave me a living relationship with him. He gave me the freedom to come and talk with him whenever I want to. Things that I could never have deserved in a million years. And that is what forgiveness really looks like. And if you know that, then just not looking back in anger for your own sake looks a pretty feeble response. In fact, if you're like the second servant in Jesus' parable, and this is why Jesus told that parable, if you're like that second servant, then actually you have never really understood what God has done for you. You see, if you refuse to forgive someone who's hurt you, it means that you can never actually have known the life-transforming effect of God forgiving you in your own life. Now, that doesn't mean that forgiving is easy, because often it isn't. But if you have made a decision, I'm not going to forgive that person, or if you're going to say that, I'll forgive, but I'll never forget, which is actually a contradiction in terms. If you're like that, then how can you ever really have understood what God has done for you? But when you do know the amazing extent of God's forgiveness, when you know that you have done so much to offend God, when you know that, as the Bible says, naturally you're an enemy of God because of all the stuff you've done, when you know that and you know that he's forgiven you, and then given you so much good, it actually enables you to pray, not just to let off somebody who's done something to you, but to pray for their good. Don't look back in anger is certainly better than trying to get your own back and being eaten up by unforgiveness. But actually, there is a better way. It's the way of Psalm 4. It's the way of recognizing what's been done, but then leaving it in God's hands and trusting his justice. It's the way of praying for your enemies rather than thinking how you can get your own back. That is what real forgiveness looks like. And it's when you forgive that not only does it restore relationships with other people, it restores your relationship with God. In peace, I will lie down and sleep. For you alone, Lord, make me dwell in safety. So much better than lying there stewing about how you can sort this person out. So much better than just not looking back in anger.